I'm very cognizant that the fact that a family lost a loved one. I'm in the middle right now, actually, writing a second letter to my donor family. I wrote a first one last April and I sent it out and I did not hear back from the family. And I'm going to keep writing them. I want them to know their loved one didn't die in vain.
Welcome back. This is your host, Lori Lee. Sorry I was gone for a few months, but we have some very exciting podcasts coming up in the next few months, and I'm so glad that you tuned in today. While Donor Diaries focuses on living donation, today's podcast is an incredible story related to deceased donation. The vast majority of people who receive a life-saving transplant actually get one from a deceased organ donor and not a living donor. The way a person dies determines what organs and tissues can be donated. In most cases, people who are evaluated for organ donation have suffered fatal head injuries resulting from a car accident or a stroke or a brain aneurysm. So sadly, and I really hate this statistic, only 2% of us die in a way that allow for our organs to be donated. So we've talked a lot on Donor Diaries about the demand for kidneys being far greater than the supply, and that only an increase in living kidney donation will end the transplant waitlist for kidneys. That still remains true. But in some cases, living donation isn't the answer because, well, you can't donate most of your vital organs without dying yourself. You can't donate your heart. You can't donate your intestines. My guest today is Philip Hanks, and he is alive today because of not one, but two deceased donors. Wait till you hear his incredible story about beating all odds several times and never giving up.
So how are you?
I'm doing well. I can't complain.
I think you know this, but I wanted to have you as a guest, not just because that when you Google five organ transplant, your name and photo is the only name and photo that comes up, but I wanted to interview you because your story is one of persistence and resilience and determination. And I really admire you for all of those qualities. And I think your story...
And faith. You can't forget faith.
We'll add faith in there. Yeah. And I think that your story is one that a struggling patient needs to hear because it is so easy to stop asking questions and to give up. And you are an example of what's possible when you don't take no for an answer.
Yes.
I think that you set an amazing example to everybody who is in a position where they really need to be advocating for themselves. So thank you so much for being here today. So your transplant story has a similar start to my transplant story. It started with a liver.
Yes.
Tell us about your liver and when your troubles began.
Sure. I used to be an avid bodybuilder. A lot of people look at me and I have pictures from back then. And they look at the pictures and they go, "That was you?" And I went about doing that the wrong way. I went about taking supplements, no steroids, but anything I could get my hands on as far as creatine and protein were the main ingredients. I had gotten up to 325. I hit a plateau. So to get over that 325, I started abusing, and I didn't know at that time that you could abuse creatine and protein, but I started abusing creatine and protein. I was doing 360 grams of protein 5 to 6 days per week.
So somebody who doesn't measure protein, tell me what that looks like.
The body can only absorb, I think it's, if I remember correctly, about 120, 160 grams of protein total.
And you were doing how much?
I was doing 360 grams of protein per day.
Wow.
So I had these 60 gram protein packets. They don't make them anymore that I know of. GNC had them. And they used to be in these black pouches. And you take that and you dump it all into one cup and it would be 60 grams. And I throw some creatine in there with it, blend it up, and built a gym in the basement. And I'd get up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning before I went to work, make a 60 gram protein shake, hit the weights. When I got through hitting the weights, jump in the shower. After I got dressed and was getting ready to hit the road on my way to work, grab another 60 gram protein shake and drink that on the way to work. And my job at that time had this massive gym in it. And instead of eating lunch like a sane person, I'd grab another 60-gram protein shake. And for lunch, I'd go and hit the weights again. When I got finished, take another 60-gram protein shake. Then when I got off work, when I got home from work, I'd hit another 60-gram protein shake, sneak down to the basement, do one more set. Before I went to sleep, one more 60-gram protein shake. And that wreaks havoc on the liver and kidneys, especially if you're, which I wasn't, not drinking enough water behind that to rinse that stuff through your system. And it started building up gallstones, kidney stones. All of that began to wreak havoc on my liver. The coup de grace was I had gone and gotten a couple of tattoos and wasn't paying attention to a question that the tattoo artist asked me. And that question was, do you mind if we use a re-sterilized needle? And that re-sterilized needle had hepatitis C in it. Hepatitis C is what they call a silent killer because you can contract it when you say 20 years old. And you wouldn't even know that you had it until you were about 50 or 60 years old. And by that time, it's already done its major damage. And the first organ it attacks is your liver. So it attacked my liver. And by the time that found out I had it, at that time, it was stage 2 cancer. And my liver was beginning to fail.
And you were a young guy when this was happening.
I was young. I was in my early 30s.
Okay.
The doctor said, well, we're not going to treat you now because they were afraid to use radiation and all that stuff. They thought it would, possibly make me sicker. Not to mention the fact they said that the only organ in the body that could regenerate itself is the liver. So they were trying to see if it would, go dormant and stay dormant or, what would happen. 2 years later, actually, it was about a year later, I met my current wife and we got engaged. Then during our engagement, just before we were getting ready to get married, I found out that I had stage 4 liver cancer. It had moved into stage 4. And they said that I had to have a liver transplant. Without the transplant, I had a short time to live. So with that being said, I tried to do everything that I could to break off the engagement with my then fiance.
Why did you want to break off your engagement?
I was raised by that single mother with a source of pride, a source of not being a burden on anyone. And with that being said, didn't want to become a newlywed who was sick and had to have her take care of me. I didn't think that would be fair to her. So I tried to break it off.
How did she handle that?
She wouldn't go anywhere. She held on with nails intact. Finally, she sat me down and she was like, okay, so what is going on? And so I finally broke down and told her. And when I told her, she was like, well, you're not going to get rid of me that easy. We're going to go through this together. And that's when I was like, okay. And I married her. We got married July 11th, November 12th. 2007 is when they called me up and they were like, hey, we have a liver for you. It should have been a joyous occasion until I wound up dying on the operating table for 3.5 minutes. Ooh. My heart stopped.
And you had a near-death experience.
I did. I totally did.
Can you tell us a little bit about the near-death experience?
Sure. Well, number one, I didn't even know I was dead. And they put this mask over your face and they tell you, okay, you're going to go to sleep. I need you to take deep breaths and count backwards from 10. And I think I made it to 7. The next thing I experienced was being part of light. Like, it's always hard to describe it, but I was part of this brilliant light that was brighter than the sun, but it didn't hurt your eyes. I was overfilled. Like, I felt like I was going to explode like a water balloon to overfill. With love, joy, peace, happiness, acceptance, and I can't even begin to describe the love and the acceptance and everything that I felt. And I'm kind of looking around trying to figure out, okay, what's going on? And I looked in front of me, and in front of me were two beings that I couldn't quite make out, two entities. I couldn't quite make them out, but I knew that they were there. And not verbally, but mentally, I was told, it's not your time. You have to go back and you're going to be okay. My next experience was waking up in a pitch black room, strapped down to the bed. And I was listening to what was going on in the room, but I also could not breathe. But it was something shoved down my throat, and I'm trying to take these deep breaths, and I couldn't. You would hear this machine inflate, and it would hold and then deflate. And I was fighting against the machine. I was on a breathing machine. So I had been in a coma for a week, and I didn't even know that. I thought it was the next day.
Wow. So it was a good thing that you were in the coma? Is that
they put me in a medical induced coma.
Okay. And then
it gave my body a chance to heal and try to recover on its own without me fighting, et cetera, and so forth, and just be relaxed. They call your family in, they have your family there surrounding you. They began to wake you up and see, and don't forget, I was dead for 3.5 minutes. So they were trying to see, you know, would I react to my name, that kind of stuff, connectivity. And
so your wife was probably scared that you were going to wake up and not have the same brain function.
Everybody was worried about that. I had brainwave activity, but they didn't know to what extent. They didn't know if I would have brain damage or anything of that nature. So this time when they woke me up, I began struggling with the straps because the second time I remember that because all I wanted to do was get my hands on that tube so I could pull it out so I could breathe. They told my wife, you have to get them to calm down. If you can't get them to calm down, we're going to have to put them back under. So she came over and she does this thing where she rubs my head. It's something that my mother used to do. Nobody knows that. That was between me and my mother. And my wife does that. She never knew my mother or anything like that. My mother passed before they ever had a chance to meet. It's just something that my wife likes to do. She was rubbing my head and speaking to me softly. And she kept telling me, you calm down. You have to calm down. If you don't calm down, they're going to put you back under. So then I began to calm myself down and just try to go with the flow of the machine. When they took the tube out, they kept me in ICU for a little bit longer to make sure that, you know, I wouldn't crash again or everything was good. So they asked me to give it a little time before I speak. I heard two nurses speaking. And so they gave me a pen and a pad to write with. And they were talking about someone who crashed and all this excitement and the whole nine yards. And so I started writing on the pad, what are you talking about? And that nurse was like, oh, you don't know? No one's told you? You didn't hear? And just as she was about to tell me, the surgeon that performed that liver transplant showed up in my doorway. The doctor stood there for a minute. He was just staring at me. And he finally comes into the room and I'm writing, hey, how are you? You know, how did everything go? When I wrote, how did everything go? He said, you scared the living, and he cursed out of me. That's where he gave me all the information. I was dead for 3.5 minutes. My heart stopped. And that's when I kind of put 2 and 2 together and was like, maybe that wasn't a dream. Maybe that was real. And then I began doubting. And then I had another experience. I was moved into, once I made it to my regular room, that was a very hard recovery. That first liver transplant, I mean, they had to go back in 2 more times. It was a rough, rough, rough transplant. I was in pain 24/7. And one night after my family left, I was up in the middle of the night. And as I was staring out of the window, kind of talking to God in my head and asking him, was that real? Why am I suffering? You know, these kinds of questions. As I was sitting there, a flash of light came out the corner of my eye and it whizzed past me. So I turned to look to see what that light was and where did it go. And all I saw was pitch blackness. However, that overwhelming feeling of love, peace, joy, acceptance, and calm came back over me, the same that I felt when I was in the light. Then I heard the spirit again, and the spirit said, you're going to be okay. Don't worry. You're going to be okay. And with that, this overwhelming sense of calm, the pain kind of subsided. I crawled into bed and for the first time in a long time, had a good night's sleep. From that point, I began recovering quicker than what I was recovering. There's other people, I'm sure, that walk the face of this planet. I know for a fact. They walk the face of this planet and have had adverse things happen to them that probably want to give up or just be like, you know, why me? You can't do all that. You got to turn to God, put your faith in him. But when I turned back to him, literally, I mean, doors opened up that wouldn't have been opened before, that even I can't explain some of the things that's happened in my life, including needing that first liver transplant and leading into 12 years later, a second transplant that took place.
So fast forwarding 12 years then, what happened? You started feeling sick or you were getting checked?
No, there was nothing wrong with me. I had gotten back in the gym again, not trying to be the Incredible Hulk again, but.
And by this time you knew what your protein intake should be?
Oh, yes, 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 definitely that. I was a healthy size again. I think I had gotten back up to about 215, so around that nature. I was living a life. I went back to work. And since this, you know, that first transplant took place in 2007, I finished climbing a corporate ladder. I became an IT director. Life was great. I went to go celebrate. So the first year, I celebrated getting that new job. I was promoted once again, just within the year of having that job. So I took the family the first time to Texas to visit other family members during Christmas. You know how brutal Chicago weather can get while everyone else was back here shoveling snow. And the second year after the second promotion, it was kind of like, hey, let's do that again. Let's go back. Let's celebrate. My youngest son played basketball in high school. He challenged me to a basketball game. So I'm like, yeah, sure. The old man can still play. Let's go. And on the basketball court, kind of waved my hand in his face to distract him from making the shot. When I did that, a pain shot up my arm and down my back. So I thought I just pulled a muscle or something. It had been a minute since I'd been on the court. I was healthy. Nothing else could have been wrong. So I was like, oh, I pulled a muscle. So I'm sitting there trying to work it out. I played one or two more games and we finished up. And by the time that we got back to my wife's cousin's house, I was in so much pain that I was in tears and I was begging for pain medication. And I don't really take a lot of pain medication. I'm the kind of person that don't want to get hooked on anything because I don't want anything controlling me. I want to be in control. And so they gave me 800 milligram tablets of ibuprofen and the bottle said, take 2 every 4 hours. So I did that. And it didn't even take the edge off the pain. So I personally decided, okay, well, maybe I should do every 2 hours. When I did every 2 hours, it kind of dulled it a little bit. Every hour, it dulled it a little bit more because I'm putting pain medication on top of pain medication. And I did that all the way down to every half an hour before my wife and her family took the pain medication from me and they wouldn't give me anymore. So I suffered for 3 more days in pain. We landed back here in Chicago and I went to the hospital where I had the first liver transplant and I reluctantly went. I spent a month and a half in the hospital while they were trying to figure out why I was having all this pain. They couldn't figure out the source of the pain, but what they told me was upon discharging me, you need a new liver because this one's beginning to fail. You need a new kidney. Because your kidney is in 4-stage kidney failure. And by the way, we're not going to do the transplants here. We're discharging you. Good luck.
Oh, so it was a harsh cutoff from that center.
It was
serving you.
It was.
Was the kidney and liver disease due to the pain meds?
So the pain medication took the kidneys over the edge. I was diabetic as well. And with the diabetes, with the sugars being unregulated, I worked a lot. So with me working a lot, I didn't eat right. I took my insulin when I remembered. So with my diabetes being not regulated very well, the ibuprofen kind of was like the final straw, final nail in the coffin, so to speak. And then the liver was struggling as well. So all of that just kind of set up the perfect storm. Now through all of this, I didn't even know I was sick. I didn't have pain. There was nothing wrong with me. I had went to the gym before that day lifting weights. So it wasn't the protein and the creatine or any of that because I had cut all that out. So when they told me they weren't going to do it, the wife then again said, well, if they're not going to do it, we don't want them to do it anyway. I did go to another Chicago hospital. they told me why the first hospital reacted the way it did and what was going on. So they showed me, they put my x-ray up, and the first hospital, when they saved my life back in 2007, scar tissue began to form in the pulmonary vein where they cut the first time. So mine was scarred up where they had put the liver in. And that scar tissue built up and created a blockage. So the thing I thought was pretty cool in the x-ray, they started showing me all these spider veins that my body began to make to continue blood flow to the organs as best as it could to go around that blockage. Those spider veins wouldn't have been enough blood flow to sustain a new liver and a new kidney. So what they decided was, we're going to go in, we're going to try to remove as much scar tissue as possible. We're going to put a stent in to that pulmonary vein to reopen it and keep it open.
So this is the second hospital agreed to do something, but it wasn't
correct.
But they didn't agree to do a transplant.
No, they were going to do it. They were preparing me for the transplant. They had to recreate the blood flow in the pulmonary vein so that the new liver and kidney could sustain. They tried three times, and three times it failed. The pulmonary vein wouldn't stay open. The stent wasn't enough to keep it open. So on the third time, the doctor literally came into the room, teared up, and he dropped his head and he said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Hanks, there's nothing else that we could do for you." That touched me, the fact that he had tears in his eyes, because that meant that he really truly cared and he really truly did everything in his power that he knew how to do. So at that point, I began freaking out a little bit, and I said, okay, well, I need to get my affairs in order. I wasn't ready to check out, but if you're telling me that there's nothing else you can do, you know, let me get my affairs in order, because I know what that means. They told me I had about a year or less to live. We went back, spoke to him again. He said, well, there is this doctor that's up in Indianapolis, and he does these unorthodox transplants. I can put you in touch with him, and you can see if you can try and get a consultation with him. We got in touch with him, and when we got there, that doctor, at first, he did not want to do the transplant. He said my case was too complicated.
Do you want to give the transplant center and your surgeon a shout out?
Yes, most definitely. So it's IU Health in Indianapolis, and Dr. Mangus, who is still to this day, he's a good friend of mine now, but that's the man that did what they said couldn't be done.
I bet he feels pretty awesome when he gets to look at you.
He does. He's an extremely humble man, very down to earth. During his consultation with him, he decides, okay, something changed his mind, and he decided, I will take the case under these circumstances. Your odds of survival are 50-50. Number two, this is a rare transplant. He had only done one similar, not quite what I had, but something similar. It was three organs. It was a liver, kidney, and stomach. The lady did great. She got out of the hospital in record time, went home, became septic, and she passed away 2 days before I came in for my consultation. So he wanted me to be aware of that. And then he told me what he was going to do. And that's when I kind of freaked out. So
can we pause for a second? I looked this up before our interview today. So the two organ combinations transplanted most frequently are kidney, pancreas, and heart, lung. Mm. And there was only 1,000 multi-organ transplants total in 2022. Yes. When I Google this and I put in five organ transplant, literally the only story that comes up over and over is yours. So, like,
I was the fifth in the country at the time to receive that transplant.
So some hospitals may have technical capabilities that allow them to take on somebody who might be considered a riskier patient than others. But they also have to worry about outcomes, because it counts against them if a year post-transplant you've died.
That's one of the reasons why he didn't want to take my case at first. He was going to deny me.
So do you know why the first two hospitals didn't want to take your case?
The first one, it was too risky, and they had almost lost me once. And they didn't feel that they had the capability to be able to pull it off. The second hospital did try to work around the blockage. when they could not work around the blockage, they told me they didn't have the expertise there. And then that's when they referred me to the hospital in Indianapolis, who he just heard about some of the work that he had done. And it was an effort. It was a last ditch effort.
And he was willing to take it on.
He was willing to take, he said that something changed his mind, is the way he put it.
Well, did you go back and ask him what changed his mind?
Well, he said, because he said it in an interview, but he said that after speaking with me and my wife, he felt that if anybody could pull through the operation, it would be me. What he told me during the consultation was he was going to go in just above the scar tissue, cut the scar, that piece of the scar tissue out along with everything connected to it. Find a donor, take a piece of that healthy piece of the vein, along with everything connected to it, connect the two pieces of the vein and all the organs that was connected to it, and put that back into me.
So what five organs is that?
That was a liver, kidney, pancreas, upper and lower intestine, and stomach.
So they gutted you.
Yeah.
What did? How many organs are left? Did they take? Is that more than half your organs?
That's everything. You have a gallbladder there.
Because you had to get this all from one single donor.
Yes.
So that could potentially be organs for five different surgeries that people need. How do they rate that in order of importance? Like, do we give five to one person or do we help five people?
It's about the need. So if one person needs two organs or one person needs five organs and they have one donor and it's a very good match, they're going to give those organs to that one person.
And what did they say the chances were that they would find a suitable donor that would be able to donate all of these organs to you? Because you were in dire need by this point, right? Like if it didn't happen, you weren't going to live.
Right.
A donor?
They told me that it was going to be a wait. It wasn't a wait. I was listed December 31st, 2020, and April 26th, 2021. That's the date of my transplant. Yeah, it was definitely an alignment that took place. You know, I do want to say I'm very cognizant that the fact that a family lost a loved one. I'm in the middle right now, actually, writing a second letter to my donor family. I wrote a first one last April, and I sent it out, and I did not hear back from the family. And I'm going to keep writing them. I want them to know their loved one didn't die in vain. I do know that they were in their early 20s. They passed away in a vehicle accident. And I'm very cognizant and very sensitive to the fact that they lost a loved one. But I want them to know that their loved one continues to live on through me. And that it made a huge difference and a huge impact.
Yeah, I can only imagine how much thought and heart goes into writing a letter like that. I hope your donor family gets the letter and that it brings them some peace. I can only imagine how bittersweet it is to receive a letter like that and how hard it must be to put your gratitude into words. So how's your health today?
Great. I'm doing so much. Let's see. Yeah, I've just been living. My health is great. I'm great.
Philip, what would you say to somebody whose transplant center tells them that they can't help?
Don't give up. Be an advocate for yourself. Speak up. Research. Push. Ask questions. As many questions. Get on their nerves. I got on everyone's nerves. Get on their nerves. Keep believing. There's got to be something. There's a last ditch effort. There's something.
And you've written a book about a lot of the stuff that we've talked about today, starting from childhood, right? And going through
the experience.
Can you tell us a little bit about your book?
Sure. So my book is called My Story, God's Glory, The Story of a Walking Miracle, which is something that the news deemed just facing the odds on the success of a rare and odd transplant. But it caused me to look back and kind of go through my whole entire life. You know, when you're facing death, you kind of do that life review thing. Well, I did that and then wrote a book about it. people constantly telling me all through my life, you can't, it's not going to happen. And then me proving them wrong. And that's what the book is about. Not giving up, holding on to faith, holding on to hope, holding on to perseverance, holding on to that one way or the other, I'm going to die trying attitude.
Anything else you want us to know before we part today?
God is still in the miracle business and business is good. I'm a prime example of that. Or if you want to reach out for a word of encouragement, feel free. Philip Hanks. And I'm here.
If you're listening to this today and you're already a registered organ donor, thank you. It's an amazing way to help others in the most basic and beautiful way when you no longer need your organs. You can save up to 8 lives and enhance the lives of more than 75 people if you're an organ and tissue donor. It's the most amazing last thing to get to do with your body when you leave this world and no longer need it. Statistics show, though, that while 90% of American adults support organ donation, only 60% are signed up as a registered donor. So if this sounds like you, where you believe it's something you should do, but you're not signed up, it's time to sign up. Do it today. It's so easy. You can do it at organdonor.gov, which I'll put in my show notes, and it takes less than a minute. Keep in mind, though, that it's ultimately your loved ones who give the okay for your organs to be donated if you're in that 2% situation where you're on life support at a hospital in a position to donate your organs. That can be a really hard choice to make in a time of crisis. So what's equally important to registering is to tell the people closest to you that it's your wish to donate your organs. So go do that today too if you haven't already done that. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Donor Diaries is produced by Rob Lee with Maitrey River Productions. You can find us on Facebook. Just search Donor Diaries Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This is Lori Lee.